Welcome to episode 66 of the Camerosity Podcast, the world's first and only open source film photography podcast. My name is Mike Ekman, and we are back for another exciting episode of Camerosity Fun. Taking a cue from the AMA panels on Reddit, for this episode, we are doing our own Ask Us Anything, where we have collected a bunch of questions from our listeners that Anthony, Paul, Theo, and Mike will answer. While we assume most of the questions will be photography related, nothing is off the table. So if you've ever wanted to know more about us, this is the episode to join. Before we get started though, from the bird sanctuary outside his front door in Gainesville, Florida, is Mr. Anthony Rue. Hey Anthony, have you seen any warblers lately?
I have seen warblers and chickadees and woodpeckers and eagles and hawks. And I'm obsessed with this application called Merlin, where it will record your ambient bird calls in your front yard and then give you a running list of what you have. And it's fascinating because, of course, I happen to live in a bird sanctuary. So it's on the migratory path and you never know what's going to show up.
Next, from his kitchen in Yellow Springs, Ohio, is Mr. Paul Rebel. Hey, Paul, have you ever cooked a steak using sous vide?
Well, yes, Mike. As a matter of fact, I did that last night. And as we say down home, it was fit to eat.
And fresh out of the emergency room with third-degree burns in his mouth is Mr. Theo Panagopoulos. Hey, Theo, how hot were those Carolina Reapers?
Oh, they're extremely hot. I've given them to a friend of mine, and he sent me a message, and I'm not quite sure I can make out the swear words that I've never heard before. So I think they're quite hot.
As always, we have a waiting room full of eager listeners, so let's let them in. Looks like we got a whole bunch of returning callers. Straight from the operating table is Ray Nason. Hey, Ray, how's your knee?
Hey, it's doing much better, thanks. I've been living vicariously playing catch-up on all the recordings. It's been nice to be able to get back into the swing of things.
Awesome. Good to see you. Patrick Rapps, welcome. Oops, sorry, I said that while I was drinking.
That's okay. I was just getting ready.
It's like when you go to a restaurant and you just put a huge bite of food in your mouth, and that's when the waitress comes by and asks if you need anything. Miles Liebeck, welcome back, Miles. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see everyone.
Are you in a different part of your house? I see stairs behind you.
I moved.
Oh, you have a new house?
Yeah. So new environment, and I've had some internet troubles the last couple episodes. So
okay.
Nice to be coming back.
All right. Mark Faulkner? I see you are in the upstairs office. I see some new stuff behind you.
Yep. Like it switched up a little bit.
Awesome. Cool. Steven Strangeways is back. Steven, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
We kept missing your time zone. You had said you wanted to come in the past couple of times and just didn't work out.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see how this one goes.
Yeah. And AJ with his wonderful shelf behind him that I love looking at. See, anything new?
Hi, guys. Actually, yeah. Thanks to you and Paul. I have now put into use my horseman.
Oh, yeah. With the rollback?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Nice.
AJ was on a couple episodes ago looking for a film back, and Paul recommended just, why don't you do the roll film back? And that's a heck of a lot easier. So looks like that's what he did. I don't know if it's, is it gas? If it's failed gas? After the European episode, we had that guy from the Czech Republic talking about the Opima, that kind of like a rangefinder. And I tried to get one, and I found one that looked okay, but I could see the leather was missing. And I tried to communicate with the seller, like, can you give me any sense that this thing even partially works? Like, does it at least go click? And he's like, as you know, Soviet camera, the fact that it exists, you should be proud, you know? And I was like, well, it didn't at all answer my question. So I didn't pull the trigger on it, but.
Well, I just finished listening to your last episode and I heard about the, somebody was talking about Miopta. I got two. I got two, like 3 months ago, a color. I got the color, the Mio Chrome, and I've got the Opimus 5.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys, you're really bad luck for me over here.
Yeah. Yeah. It affects all of us. We've had many instances where, you know, Anthony went and bought the Pen D immediately after an episode. Theo's been, you know, hunting down some stuff that we've been trying to get lately. We talked about the Telka. But tell us about your Telka.
Yeah, we talked about the Telka in the last one. And, someone pointed out that it was actually available in Australia. So I sort of looked at it and I thought, oh, do I not? Of course I did. So I ended up buying it as it happens. And it is actually right here. Beautiful camera. Slight problem though, the rangefinder seems to be broken on it. So unfortunately it's going back. But Anthony, you're spot on. This is an absolutely gorgeous camera.
Yeah, Anthony's been a big fan of the Telka 3.
The metalwork on that, like that nickel plated top plate, is just stunningly beautiful.
Oh, it is. It's absolutely gorgeous. And, it's got the previous owner's name engraved. I'm not sure you can see that, but they've gone all fancy with the writing and it just enhances it. It just looks really nice, actually. It's really a shame for it to go back, but I just don't want it to have to deal with a broken rangefinder.
You said does that have a social security number engraved on there or something like this?
No, we don't tend to do that in Australia. It tends to be license numbers, but... No, it's got someone's name here and their suburb. Not sure how much that would help, but anyway, that's exactly what's on there.
I'm probably in the minority here, but when I find cameras with like a social security number or something engraved, that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, you know, unless I'm looking for like a mint display piece that I'm never actually going to use, where I want it to be perfect, I actually think that's really cool. I had a Canon F1. That had the guy put his phone number, his name, and his social security number on the side of the prism, two different spots on the body, and he engraved it in like the side of all the lenses. It's like he had one of those jewelry store, you know, the vibrating little pens to etch things in it. He went a little crazy with it. And I ended up getting rid of that camera only because like the metering system was just really janky. The prism, I know it's interchangeable, but the prism that it had the signature black stripe that runs straight down the center of the prism when things start to desilver. So the camera was just, it was a road warrior battle tested war, whatever, but it had gone almost too far beyond, but I had it been in good operating condition. What was that? Who was the Leica, the Lenny Kravitz one? That's like aged, right, Paul?
Oh yeah. He reliced them.
Yeah. This was like authentic Lenny Kravitz, like true brassing and just wore to shit everywhere.
The owner engraving was extremely popular in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
It you know, at the camera shop, and Paul can probably admit and, you know, comment on just how much gear came in, which was great because we would pay so little for it because of the engraving.
Do you remember the Brinks security markers?
Yes.
Brinks was Sanford, was the company that made them, who makes magic markers.
Yep.
Or Sharpies. They had a thing called a Brinks security marker, which was invisible. So you could write your name and address or phone number or something somewhere inside the camera or somewhere where you could get to it easily to see it. Well, it was only visible under ultraviolet light. If you had the camera stolen, it wasn't a deterrent at all, because the guy who was stealing it couldn't see it.
Yeah.
But if you needed to identify it was yours, it was easy. I mean, you would just show the cops that under the light, and it would have your name and phone number on.
Now, I'm surprised, Paul, that there wasn't some company that thought it would be a good idea to make like custom nameplates for cameras. Like, no one thought to do that, like personalize your camera.
Actually, there were a lot of jewelry stores did that back in the 70s. And I mean, you could go in and have a little gold plate done fancy script on it, and they would make it whatever size you wanted. I mean, I've seen those. They're just exceptionally nasty.
Yeah.
A lot of the earlier camera shops had them, and a lot of good sporting shops had them as well, that were basically direct importers at the time when we in the United States didn't have a distribution. They would actually buy a product, whether it be, whatever camera it was, or even a fly fishing reel, and they would put their own store name label on it.
Yeah.
I have a few cameras that have those unique little placards that, to be honest with you, without the store placard, I would have no interest in buying them. But it's just so unique, and it's inexpensive cameras through expensive cameras. There was no rhyme or reason to it, which is, it's kind of a, you know, 20 years ago, I probably would have said, who needs a box camera like this? I don't really do box cameras, but I see that little emblem or placard on the camera, and it's extremely appealing. You know, it becomes very, very unique.
Well, Paul has a really nice Kodak Brownie from Yellowstone Park that he
yeah, I was just thinking about that. That was
I'll see you both at the end of the month. So maybe you might want to bring that along, Paul.
Yeah, I'm still not sure what that's all about. I mean, it really is a vintage sticker. Okay. So I don't know if some family went to Yellowstone, they bought this decal or something and stuck it on the side of their camera, or if it really was something that was sold at the concessionaire at the park, because it was actually before Yellowstone was a national park.
Interesting.
It was Yellowstone Park.
Interesting.
Those trunks, you used to buy those for your trunks, for steamer trunks. So I'm wondering
right.
what that means.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same kind of thing.
I was going to give AJ a hard time and say he went from sheet film to roll film. I went the opposite direction today.
No way.
This one is not a K20. This is
an
F8. So I wind it to cock it.
Okay.
Oh, wow. So he's holding an aircraft camera. Is it a Fairchild?
No, it's a Keystone.
Keystone. Okay.
Fairchild may be a Deadpool one, but this one's an F8. So it's like it's 5x7 format. And it's got a glass plate back here, not that vacuum business. So you can stick one single sheet of film on it in a dark room and take an image instead of the roll film.
That's cool.
So, Patrick, that's your new street photography kit, is it?
That weighs 16 pounds.
Just remember when everyone was talking about all the heavy cameras, like who would ever shoot an RB or an RZ Mamiya camera?
Yeah.
Puts them to shame, well, doesn't it?
I actually did it because I'm going to get a ride in a biplane and I'm going to take it up in a biplane and shoot it the way it's supposed to be.
That's cool.
So Ray mentioned he'll see me and Paul. What he was alluding to is we'll all three of us will be at the Cincinnati Ohio Camera Show on Saturday, March 23rd. So that's still, over 2 weeks from now. But anybody who is in that region of the country, Louisville, Kentucky, Southern Indiana, Ohio, if you have nothing going on, come visit us. Paul and I will have a table. Ray's going to come. Is someone driving you, Ray?
So this is my first road trip out. And my wife was adamant that she come with.
Okay.
So she'll be my co-pilot / if I can't handle the drive. And she'll understand what my job really pertains to.
Okay.
She's like, I can drop you off and I'll go shopping. And I'm like, no, we're going to go from stop to stop. I'll see dealers along the way, obviously, but it's a good test. And it's actually an easy drive as compared to New York City or Boston or even DC with traffic. You know, the drive is just, it's long, but it's an easy drive. And this will kick back my travel for the year. So, rekindle it. I'm looking forward to it. I started driving last week. I'm ready. I'm ready for sure. She may curve my spending. we'll definitely have, I'll have some deals to, she's a great salesperson to, remove a lot of the items that I'll bring. I'll guarantee that, but it'll be fun.
Yeah. I had my son with me when I was at the last show in November and he was my little helper too. So it is nice to have someone to kind of help out a little bit. Cool. It's good. I'm excited to see you guys. I've been there once before. The last time it was, in fact, that was the first time I'd ever met you, Paul, at face to face.
Yes.
So I went to the show, but I didn't sell anything that time, but I'm going to bring just a couple boxes worth of stuff. Hopefully I can get rid of, cover the cost to travel in a hotel room. Cause I got a hotel right in that same hotel. So
here's I got an eBay story from today. It's two good eBay stories.
Okay.
First, I'd loaded a bunch of TLRs from Kurt's stuff. And one of the things I loaded was a Voigtlander Brillant, a very nice one, focusing model in the leather case. And I had put it in at $75. And, it's just so cheap. I don't say anything about it. I mean, I say, hey, here, this is a collectible camera. It looks nice on your shelf. So I get an email from this guy. He says, hey, I'm a Camerosity listener. I really would like to have this. He said, does it work? So I checked it and it worked great. I mean, even the focusing screen on it was
good. Yeah, they usually do. Those cameras are pretty robust.
So I sent him an offer of $25 off of the $75 price and said, thank you for being a listener.
Nice. See?
So he bought it like 2 weeks ago. My phone just, cash register just rung on my phone. So Alex, it'll be shipped out to you tomorrow.
All right, Alex. Yeah, the Brillant and the Brilliance, second only to the Kodak vest pockets. Kurt had probably 40, I think, of the Brillants. Yeah. I have a couple. I've looked at them, and the names form is a little bit confusing. There was the V6, and then there's just ones called the Focusing Brillant, and then there's the ones that just didn't focus at all. But one I did not see was there was one that came with a Heliar. We never came across any of those.
Heliar is very hard to find.
Yeah, you get them with a Scopar.
Yeah, Scopars, and I have two of those. But there was another one that was the self-cocking shatters on the real early ones. They were on the market for a long time, so there were a lot of variations on lenses.
So this is our Ask Me Anything, Ask Us Anything. A survey of the people here real quick. How many of you actually know what AMA stands for? Was Ask Me Anything? So I see Steven shaking his head. Mark is. Miles does. I knew it, and so did Anthony. Okay, Ari did too. Okay, so we're over 50%. We were worried that it was like the Australian, Manicure Association or something, right? Wasn't that what Theo people from Australia might think?
It was the Medical Association. The Manicure Association works as well.
So the idea was, I mean, we've had open topic episodes before. What we thought would be different about this is solicit some questions just from now that we're on it, Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on Discord. People still sometimes comment on the posts that I make on my website too. Plus, give you guys the opportunity to ask questions too. Just kind of anything, like stuff you've always wanted to know. So I don't know, Theo, were you tracking some of the questions we had? I know we had some on Instagram.
Let's do one that was online first, and then we'll throw it to the crowd and then come back to online and just rotate that way. So the first question I saw was from Andy Hater. And he says, I have a Lord 4D 35mm camera. It has an unusual feature I've not seen before. There is a film cutter built into the bottom of the camera. When would you use this feature?
It sounds like the Exact does, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. It's exactly like the Exact does. Pardon the pun, but the Lord 4D, I'm not familiar with that one. Is anyone familiar with that camera?
That was one of the Okaya, I think was the name of the company that made it. One of many Japanese camera makers of the early to mid 50s. I always thought they were kind of comparable to Iris in that, solid built, good lenses, not too high end, but not cheap either. I've actually never come across one though. I do know that some of the higher end ones were pretty nice, but it sounds like he said it was a 4D. Is that what he said?
4D.
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 I've got a 4B.
Does it have the knife?
Yeah, it does, I believe.
It does? Okay.
You use it to, if you only want to shoot a partial roll of film, you can open the back, run the knife across it, cut it, pull out what you need to develop from what you've just shot, and then transfer the film to another camera. It keeps you from having to rewind it back in and then count frames forward to figure out where you were in the roll. And it was the Exacta is, I think every Exacta has the little guillotine knife in it.
Just about every Exacta has that film cutter. And let's remember, guys, remember when we used to call film is cheap? Film is no longer cheap. So, just to test a roll or clip test, it was often called to test your lighting for cameras that didn't have any sort of either preview, whether it's Polaroid or today being digital. And it's not a sheet of film. So if you think about the time frame when rolls of film were becoming more and more popular, it's a pretty clever way of doing it for sure.
I understand that the Okoyas had that cutter because film was particularly expensive in the 50s in Japan. The only problem with that 3D is you have to do it in a dark room because if you cut it, it doesn't go into anything. I think the Exact is have something, a canister they go into. There's no receiving canister.
If you're going to use the knife, you would do cassette to cassette transport. I don't have a 4D, so I don't know how it's laid out. But every camera I've seen, the KMZ Start, the Russian SLR, has that feature. You guys saw, I haven't actually stood up, but this camera is called the Beira, has a film cutter too in it. So it works just like the Exact, except it's on the top. There's a blade that goes inside and it does the same thing, but you wouldn't go to a take-up spool like you typically think where the film just freely wraps around it. You would do cassette to cassette. And when you do the slice, you would then use the knob to kind of back off the unshot film a little bit, so that you're not wasting too much of it. And then you could open the back of the camera because the film that you've already shot has gone into another cassette, which would be light-proof. So I assume the Lord works the same way, but all these, like the Beira, the KMZ Start, the Exactas, there were a few others that had that feature too, but you needed to pair it up with cassette to cassette. So that would, then you'd have to do it in a dark room, I guess. You'd have to cut it, open it up. I mean, at that point, why not just open it and use scissors? I don't know. I guess they were grasping at something to make them stand out. But yeah, so the answer to the question is, for people who wanted to do partial roles, you know, not just in Japan, but like even here in the United States, I did research on film prices in an article on my site a while back, and the inflation adjusted cost for a 36 exposure roll of Kodachrome with development in the 50s is like comparable to about $35 in today's money. So it's been expensive for quite a while. And if you have a 36 exposure roll and you've only shot 12 of those pictures and you want to see them, then you don't want to have to waste, you know, or have to wait to finish the rest of that roll. You just cut it out. I mean, you're going to lose one or two exposures in doing so, because then you'd need to reattach the part you cut off to continue with it. But it's better to lose, you know, one or two exposures, but be able to develop and see the shots that you've already done.
Speaking of the Lord 4D, I'm just looking at a picture of it. It's actually quite a nice looking camera. It looks like, I mean, I don't know how well it's built, but it actually looks quite nice.
We had someone on the show recently that had, I think, the 5D, and he said that it has a bottom trigger wind. So it seems to me that Okaya, the company who made that camera, was looking for features to add to their cameras to help them stand out from just another Japanese rangefinder.
Nice. I think maybe now we throw the question out to people on the call.
I think there's been a small discussion in the Facebook page about this, but I'm curious if y'all have considered like a Patreon page or like merch to help kind of like offset that the time commitment that you four have.
We've toyed with the idea of merch a number of times. It's just doing it. that's kind of been the hassle. There's a couple places that, you know, where it's on demand so that we don't have to have like an inventory of t-shirts and mugs or something like that. I'm not against it. I mean, honestly, the money part of it isn't really much of an issue. You know, it's the time thing. So unless people are wanting to learn how to edit audio files, that would be nice. It does help tremendously though, having like Theo does a lot of the social media stuff. Anthony has always been, you know, our Instagram guy. I kind of took the surge with Discord. So we kind of all split up, you know, our responsibilities, because I still maintain my blog, you know, Theo does his. I, you know, have a job and kids and stuff like that. So I even sometimes amaze myself that I'm able to do as much as I can, but the time is really more the issue for us. But yeah, I mean, it'd be kind of cool to have some swag, you know, maybe we go to these camera shows with Paul and Ray and have some Camerosity t-shirts.
I've got some ideas for some cool t-shirts, but then
yeah,
I sort of had like real life intrusion that sort of kept me from being able to realize those. But as soon as I am feeling up to it, I'll probably put together three or four designs, run them by the crew, see, and then, you know, come up with one of these on-demand printers.
Hey, I got a question for Anthony. Now, a lot of our listeners probably don't realize that Anthony's has an advanced degree in cinema, and has produced film festivals and has a tremendous background in the history of cinema. And I've always been curious, and we've never talked about this, so this is going to take him totally by surprise, but I have a question. What do you think was Elvis's best movie?
King Creole.
Oh, okay.
By far.
I was sure you were going to go for Blue Hawaii.
No, King Creole. It's really, okay. I just rewatched it about a month ago, and it's really an interesting movie, and it's got some great songs. And I think it's pretty much the only one where he actually felt like he was allowed to be an actor. You know, he wasn't just a caricature. Now, the worst movie is one that was actually filmed about 30 miles from where I am right now, called Follow That Dream. And it was sort of like a Beverly Hillbillies kind of a story, where Elvis and his family are on a road trip in this like jalopy, and it breaks down on a causeway in Florida. And they decide just to make that their home. And so they pitch a camp and create sort of like a Gilligan's Island on this causeway. And it's the causeway from Inglis to Yankee Town. And oh boy, is it a stinker. But that was also the movie that when a like a 12-year-old Tom Petty got his parents to give him a lift down to watch them film, and he met Elvis, and that was the moment that Tom Petty decided to be a rock and roller. So I guess there's something good that came out of it.
Well, I mean, and most people know this too, that Elvis himself was inspired by Forrest Gump. So he taught him how to swing his hips.
But yeah, Follow That Dream is just the worst. But yeah.
When I asked that question, Anthony, I thought I was going to throw you. But instead.
He spent a lot of time thinking about this.
I did. I rehearsed this. And there you go. You totally screwed up my bit. So, but on the other hand, I got to go see if I can find Follow That Dream.
Well, you know, I got to tell you that for about 15 years of my life, I probably saw between 500 and 600 films a year just because it was my job. And I would see at least 2 movies a day, pretty much every day of the year. And I've got like a weird ability to retain minutia about these movies.
So Anthony, did your love for still photography come out of cinema, or was it the other way around?
It was kind of, well, you know, actually going back, it was an intro to photography class that got me into 16 millimeter film production. And, you know, I would definitely say that it was still photography first, then film. But then the other way around is that for how I like to shoot things and how I think about composition, it almost entirely comes from the movies. You know, like when I pick up the G617, I'm thinking about Sergio Leone. I'm thinking about CinemaScope. You know, I think that, you know, like widescreen composition and how to shoot, you know, a portrait or a 2-shot or, you know, establishing shots. I think all of that comes, for me as a photographer, comes back from the movies.
I think Miles sent a question to you, Anthony. Do you track your films on Letterboxd?
You know, everybody bugs me to do that, and I haven't. I should. You know, I've been, you know, having some health issues recently, and I'm watching at least one, if not two, Criterion Channel movies a day, and I should be using Letterboxd, but I haven't.
Sorry, what's Letterboxd?
It's like a online diary of your films that you've seen, and you can do like reviews and
oh
yeah, it's like a film community. It's like Camerosity for film nerds.
I should use that because I can never remember the name of films or who the actors are or anything. So yeah, that would actually help a lot.
How I can remember if I've seen a movie before is when I start playing it the second time and I'm 15 minutes in, you're like, wait a minute, I've seen this before.
But then you're committed sometimes.
Yeah. So it's not a movie, but something, and Anthony, you may have already seen this, but I recently got into The Bear.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's
I have a hard time watching it because I get PTSD because yeah. Especially the first season's a little too close. Like the episode where they accidentally turn on the automated ticket system and it's kicking out the orders. I really had a hard time watching that because I have had those days.
Episode 7 of the first season of this show. It's a 30-minute show. The basic plot is this like Michelin star chef, you know, trained, worked in the fanciest restaurants. His brother owned a sandwich shop in Chicago and he dies. So he leaves the shop to his brother to run, you know, after he's gone, and the shop is just in complete disarray. So this high-end chef comes in to try and fix the issues with this show, with the shop. And it's a fictitious scripted show. Each episode's only half an hour. It's really well done. The acting is great. Episode 7 is, I've worked in food service before, but it's been a long time. And even that gave me some PTSD too. It's just so anxiety, but in a good way. I mean, it's worth watching. And, you know, another thing that I think shouldn't be dismissed with that show is, more than anything I've ever seen in any movie, any TV show, it shows what the city of Chicago really looks like. I mean, they did a fantastic job of capturing the mood and being in Chicago.
Well, just the sequences of them going to work and like being at a yeah. specific platform for the L and getting off at a certain stop and how the neighborhoods are different.
Right.
And they really have an eye for that, you know, sure. for Chicago.
I mean, Chicago's not as big as New York City. It's not as big as Los Angeles. There's plenty of cities in the world that are much larger. And, you know, Chicago's known for corruption and, you know, a lot of bad things, but there's a ton of good things about it too. It's a gorgeous city, you know, to have this major metropolis with a river running right through the middle. There's a beach, there's a zoo. You go to Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago and you're staring at giraffes and there's skyscrapers right behind you. So the juxtaposition of things that you can do in Chicago that you don't expect to see in a major city.
Well, you can even Airbnb a Mies van der Rohe apartment in the tower off of Lincoln Park.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have the money for that though.
So Theo, next question.
Yeah.
Next question. Okay. By the way, you've just described a lot of Sydney's features as well. So that could be another option to visit.
Yeah.
Michael Carnell has written in and said, questions for all the hosts. What photography related ephemera do you collect, and or what is your favorite item of such? Things like that Minolta album or advertisements and marketing material, you know, the related stuff that is just too cool to pass up for a camera nerd.
One thing that I'm always on the lookout for in either used bookstores or in like Friends of the Library book sale, I'm kind of a sucker for like pre-war film journals and film books. Like there's some amazing manuals, you know, like the Kodak How to Take Good Pictures book. But more than that, there were a series of like hobbyist and enthusiast journals that came out in the 1930s. And it's just fascinating to see people, you know, coming to grips with the changes in the technology and, you know, experimenting with style and just coming to terms with what it meant to be, you know, having the world of photography open up to them suddenly. Yeah, I've got way too many 1930s, 1920s, maybe 1940s journals and books stacked up in the corner.
Mark Faulkner, you're not a host, but you have some cool stuff on the wall behind you. Some good like ephemera, some advertising, it looks like.
Yeah, I like advertising when I can find it. Even if it's not original, like the sort of collage poster thing, and like even that Kodak sign I had printed up because I couldn't find one that I liked in good enough condition. So that sort of thing is kind of interesting to me. I also love this kind of random little trinket. Like this is called like a posograph, and it's all unfortunately in French, but you move these different sliders and it'll help give you exposure and things like that. So just really weird, outdated tools of the trade are also quite interesting to me.
I like advertising too, but like you said, it's really expensive. I mean, there's a whole bunch of antique stores within like a 30-minute drive in Crown Point, Indiana that I like to go to a lot. And I mean, they have Budweiser and sports stuff and Shell gasoline all over the place. Every one of them I go to, they have some kind of antique advertising, but I find nothing for photography. I've never once seen a single Kodak sign. And, you know, you can go on eBay and find some of those old ones, but the prices for them are just ridiculous. Like I'm not spending $600 for a 1-foot by 2-foot little sign, you know, or a cardboard cutout. I got a couple of these reproductions that I have on my wall. So it looks antique-y, but it's just cheap, thin metal that someone printed on it. But they look pretty cool on the wall. I have an Agfa one. I have a Fuji one. There's an Ilford one somewhere. My favorite thing, though, is I'm not going to move it because I can't get it on camera, but I have it was a promotional desk lamp, a Kodak promotional desk lamp. It says it looks like it's Tiffany glass, but it's just plastic. I think, Paul, you told me once before that those were marketing guys would allow dealerships to buy them with like Kodak dollars or something.
Right. Yeah. Kodak had a catalog that was for dealers that, we could order what they call premium products, and they were, I had a rubber raft, a wonderful inflatable rubber raft that was terrific. I mean, it was very high grade and you could pay for it with co-op advertising dollars. So it really didn't cost you anything, but they made a coffee pot, you know, a coffee pot that looked like a film can.
I've seen those.
The Kodak store was actually the coolest thing though. In Rochester, there were tunnels that connected the buildings. Because the workers didn't really want to go out in the middle of the winter and get from one building to another. So there were tunnels that connected them. Well, down in one of the tunnels was a Kodak store that you could buy Kodak, very high quality Kodak sweatshirts and tennis shoes and just all kinds of stuff with the Kodak logo. So whenever I went, I would just load up on that stuff.
Paul, you also collect EverReady cases, right?
I donated all my EverReady cases to the waste management. I figure they knew what to do with them, and they sent them to the recyclers.
I had 3 contacts EverReady, like actual Zeiss Icon contacts. 2 of them were for probably the 2A or 3A. And then 1 looked like it was for the Contax SLR. And I threw them on eBay thinking, well, all right, maybe I could sell these because they were in nice shape and they actually were for Contax. And I got someone to pay me $20 for them. I was like, hell yeah. You know, and with the great thing is about shipping EverReady cases is they're their own packing material. Don't have to bubble wrap an EverReady case.
I think one of my favorite things that I found, I got lucky on, was at a flea market. I found it was like a Kodak advertising film dispenser. So it has like the plexiglass dividers, and you can just put, I'm still trying to fill that up downstairs. It's down in the other camera area, but love that sort of stuff.
I've seen some people, it's none of us here, but I've seen some people on like Facebook where over the years they've collected empty 35 millimeter cassettes, like all the different kinds. And if you get enough of them together and like glue them to like a miniature shelf, it looks super cool because of all the different varieties of cassettes that have been made over the years. So you can kind of make art out of some of the just basic photography stuff. And I like, you can't see it now, but I like having my shelf and, you know, like where I keep my Soviet cameras, I'll have like an empty roll of Smina film, you know, or something that relates to the country that that's from. I have some Orvo, you know, where I keep my East German cameras. I have Kodak old Panatomic X boxes empty by my Kodak stuff too. So I kind of like to break up the nonstop cameras and put in some little, you know, neat little trinkets and such like that to make the display look a little bit more visually appealing.
There's this one of my friends from down in Cincinnati is a guy named Tim Jeffries. Has bought a number of cameras from me over the years, but Tim took, I think it's about a 14 by 14 inch square piece of black masonite and made a clock out of it. You know, he bought the works, an electronic clock, of course, 1 AA battery power, and he put film cans for the numbers. And it's just the coolest thing. He made one and gave it to me. I've got it down in the darkroom, but that was a cool thing. And he used Kodak and Agfa Fuji. You know, so if you went to 10 minutes past Agfa, you know, you could see what time it was.
So no one's actually said camera lamps. No one here.
Camera lamps.
Clicks camera lamps.
Well, I like mine. The Kodak one that I have, I put like a little 3-watt LED bulb in it and I never turn it off. So
no, he's
when
talking about cameras made into lamps.
Oh, okay. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. Camera lamps.
We had a guy years ago that would take broken cameras and turn them into clocks. And he did that for 20 years. And I would, you know, he was just so proud and so happy. And it's like, what are you doing? Why are you ruining that camera?
I was in a camera shop, I think in Lansing, Michigan, if I remember correctly. I can't remember the name of the store, but they had a couple just regular normal desk lamps with a shade. But instead of a normal shade, someone had taken slide film, strips of slide film. Yep. And made like a light shade with that. And that was really neat looking. But you'd have to find uncut slide film, though, obviously.
I had a dealer in Buffalo, Continental Camera, that they wouldn't sell it to me. But there was it was a Kodachrome, the early Kodachrome slide. And it was the shade to the lamp itself. So the lamp, obviously, the light inside would eliminate the slides. It was very well made. I've never seen another one like that before.
I guess you could do it with the slides too. You just maybe like tie them together somehow instead of using the strips of film. But that's a really clever idea.
It was pretty neat.
Do you remember the Duratrans that Kodak used to send to dealers?
Absolutely.
There are so many cool things that Kodak used to do that if we only knew now, if we only knew then what we know now, we would have brought them home and saved them. But the Kodak gave their dealers a lighted display that was like 24 by 36 inches. And once a month or every 6 weeks or 2 months or something, they would send you a new transparency to put in that display. And they were made out of the, they were made with the Duratrans material, which is basically just a transparency. But there was some wonderful stuff. I mean, they used some of the best photographers, you know, and around to do the pictures.
I'm trying to think of the main photographer that Kodak used. I'm friends with his son, but he's from Rochester. He still runs a photo club. And there was an episode on his life, on what he did for Kodak. And he even built an underwater housing. He started off shooting all the Duratrans initially and all their advertisement. And then as he got older, they started, you know, selecting different photographers to come on and work for them. But the great, great story. Awesome story.
Well, there were two types of material. There was Duratrans, which
and
was
Duraflex.
Duraflex, which was a non-transparent. It was a hard copy. It was like plastic.
Correct.
But they were beautiful. I mean, the colors and the durability on them was just terrific.
And usually in the stores, I think ours was like a 5 or 6 foot panoramic picture.
Yeah.
Really a large, beautiful.
Right. And that was they started out putting them in Grand Central Station in New York City. Yes. They had the huge mural. I mean, they were just mammoth in size, but great stuff.
Well, I was going to say, I've got a question for Mike, Paul, and Theo. And that is that, you know, we all know that eBay is becoming a bit problematic, a bit difficult to navigate or at least find anything interesting in anymore. So what are your favorite alternatives to eBay for either looking for new cameras or for selling cameras? What are, you know, if eBay were to just, you know, fall off the internet tomorrow, what places would you go to buy and sell?
I was going to say, there's a few places that I've been looking at. There's a local, they're not auction, it's basically a sales, local sales type place where you can do it by location or across Australia and so on, called Gumtree in Australia. And that I find some good deals there, but it can be a bit dodgy. There's no warranties, there's no nothing there. So yeah, if you can find somewhere locally where you can go and pick things up, it's pretty good. I recently went, I saw a bulk loader being put up for sale. And I noticed that the counter had, you know, showing that most of it was in there. And I went there and I got a whole bunch of Fuji, ECN2 films, you know, that came with it as well. And a bunch of little cameras. So yeah, you can get some good deals because people don't know what they're doing with on it. And they just put things up. Facebook Marketplace is starting to become a bit more popular, but again, it's fraught with danger. And this one's where it's really fraught with danger, but more to the wallet than anything else, is the auction houses sending me emails constantly. I look through those and go, oh, okay, that's really nice. But I've got to be really careful these days because, I recently bought some stuff from the UK, Northern Ireland, actually, so even slightly offbeat from the Great Britain itself, and they came back and it was a great deal, but by the time I actually took into the postage and the handling and the fees, it was like, okay, this is not such a great deal. I was quite happy with what I got because it didn't end up taking me over the edge, but it's very easy for me to just have ordered one big thing and suddenly the shipping would have been just out of this world.
I know that Ira uses, I think it's Yahoo Japan. Do you have any alternative sources in Japan that you prefer?
No, it's actually, I do use a app and it's escaping the name for me at the moment, but it actually piggybacks off the back of Yahoo Japan and it actually translates for you. So it automatically translates and they work as an intermediate. So you can actually contact them and say, look, I want to ask a question to the seller here. And they'll actually jump on and they'll actually ask a question to the seller for you. And what they do is they order the goods because a lot of the Japanese sellers won't sell overseas. So they'll order the goods, they'll actually receive them for you and then on ship them for you. And their fees are actually really reasonable. But it helps because you can actually ask questions because the descriptions don't necessarily translate really well. So they'll actually go and contact the seller for you and ask the question and come back with an answer for you. I'll try and look up what it's called, but it's a really handy app or site that actually helps you out there. And I've bought a few things there. In fact, I'm actually shooting a camera at the moment, which I did buy through that, which is the Takano Mine 6 with the Takuma lens. It's yeah, it it was described as, you know, it needs a service and so on. So I knew what I was getting there. Got it at a really decent price. It came in. It's been serviced by Jess. And it shoots fantastically now. So it is worthwhile because you can get stuff at really good prices through Japan's Yahoo.
I don't know if this is the one you're thinking of, but one that Ira used, he's told me, is called Buye, B-U-Y-E-E .jp. They're a Japanese proxy service. So it works how you describe. They're an English speaking proxy for what you how you know Yahoo Japan, Mercari, Rakuten. I don't know how to pronounce it. So you can search for a lot of stuff, not just cameras, of course. But there's a couple good services like that, and you know it's good to buy things straight from Japan that aren't as common. You know, like lenses and such for less obscure or more obscure cameras that are harder to find on eBay. But that's a good one.
Yeah, it's a very similar one to what I use.
Yeah.
Just the name, Zen Market. There it is. Zen Market.
Okay.
Yeah, it is really good. And it's really handy. I mean, they ship all over the world and they'll help you, and you end up earning something called Zen points, which actually help offset some of the costs occasionally.
Now, Paul, you pulled out of Etsy completely, right?
Yeah, I dropped out of Etsy. They raised their fees, and I found that it was just taking too much time.
Right.
People, buyers who didn't know what they were looking at, trying to, it just was a nuisance. So I did. I buy a lot of stuff on Fred Miranda. You're not going to find anything highly collectible there usually, but for higher end usable type stuff, Fred Miranda is very reliable. I sell some high end film cameras there, and I bought a lot of stuff from Fred. There's somebody else too. I can't remember exactly. There was someone else that is more attuned to the collectible market, but for high end user stuff, it's Fred Miranda is good. It's well worth the $30 a year or whatever it costs to be able to buy and sell there.
What about the people here that aren't hosts? Have you had any luck on places other than eBay?
There's a great little place called Yellow Springs, Ohio. I found so many good things.
Go to Paul's house.
No, I'm lucky that I travel for a living, and I go from the tip of Maine to DC out to Cincinnati is my, you know, Monday through Friday gig. And then I'm Texas out in Vegas. And there's a little code term we use at one of the trade shows with one of my colleagues who's also he's more or less a collector. His name is Dan Cooney. Dan would say, we need to buy some sand for some sandbags. Let's go find some sand. So the code term, if you would, is outsourcing it, you know, antique malls primarily, is how you get any sand? Need any sand? So that's been my go-to. Although recently, more and more camera stores I've had better success at.
Really?
Believe it. Yeah.
It's my experience when you go to a camera store that has old stuff, they either don't want to sell it at all or their prices are eBay plus.
You have to have the relationship. And I guess
that's my true relationship
with them being in the industry is a little bit different. But I'm finding less and less. And, you know, the antique store prices are
ridiculous.
Are getting extremely out of hand. And then and any flea markets. I started doing 4 flea markets on a Sunday when I'm home, and they've been, you know, yeah, it's $35 for a roll of film that's expired 25 years ago, you know, or it's $400 for a K1000 or a Canon 8E1.
Wow.
Where it used to be great. It used to be phenomenal.
Yeah. Down here in Florida, Craigslist is completely dried up. I haven't seen, a decent deal on Craigslist in probably 2 years. And at least in Florida, again, you know, it used to be Florida was the place where, you know, people would come to retire. They'd bring their old cameras down with them, and you could almost always find something through some sort of local sale. And it's been 4 years since I've seen that. And if you go on to Facebook Marketplace in Florida.
Well, think about it, though. The types of cameras it's that
hundreds and like hundreds this of AE1s group, for I think, $250
typically is most interested in, we'll just say, from maybe the 30s. To the 60s, maybe even 70s. Like, right. I mean, obviously there were good cameras from the 80s and 90s, but we want the Leicas, we want the Lord 4Ds and, you know, that era of cameras. But I think it's safe to say that almost all original owners of the cameras that we would collect are all dead, or damn close to it. Like, so what I'm trying to say is I feel like the majority of the collectible cameras that we're most likely to be interested in are already beyond their original owners. So I feel what you said, Anthony, you know, people go down to Florida and they have, you know, those original owners, that kind of makes sense. I'd be willing to bet there was that initial wave, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago where there was just a boatload of estate sales with good camera stuff. But I think those cameras have gone to somebody else, you know, hoarders, you know, or something. Someone else bought it. Maybe they're sitting on the walls of an Applebee's somewhere as decorations or something like that. But, you know, a lot of those old cameras are beyond their original owners now with their next custodians, if you will. So I feel like that probably is why they're a little bit harder to find. And the where you can get them, you know, eBay was I think eBay's still the best place to go. It certainly isn't perfect. It's not as great as it used to be, but you can still reasonably find almost anything you want there. And it's still a viable option for selling. It's just, it's, you know, not as good as it used to be, at least in my opinion.
The other part of it is the market changes. I mean, what's out there, like on collectibles, what's collectible? Is collectible from the 1960 is the cutoff?
Yeah.
Like right now, Nikon FE2s and FM2s, which 5 years ago were very hot cameras and cameras that, you know, a lot of people were getting into film photography. They wanted those cameras because they would use the manual focus lenses. Now you can't give them away. I mean, it's, and there's nothing wrong with the cameras. Wow. They've aged very, very well compared to an F3 or an FA. You know, they don't have the electrical issues, the LCD issues that F3s and FAs have.
I think the prices are on a downswing. I'm not saying they're rock bottom, but the peak that we saw maybe during the pandemic when everybody was at home buying shit online, I feel like, you know, especially if you're a seller, you're not getting the high dollars that you would 2-3 years ago.
I think you're exactly right. And Leica M3s, for example, were $1,400 a year and a half or 2 years ago. Now they're $1,100 to $1,000.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the market is changing significantly. Lens prices have stayed the same, but body prices have really dropped. Right.
Well, lenses will always appeal to people who can use them digitally.
Yes.
I mean, that, unless it's an obscure mount or a brand no one's ever heard of before, I mean, any adapted lens is going to remain popular forever, within reason, of course.
I do have a question for Paul, though, you know, with his eBay shop. Paul, why is there a picture of you holding up a number, you know, in a police station or a jail or something as your profile picture?
One of the things that I did was develop mugshot systems for police departments. And this was back in film days. And what I did was I had a Ricoh KR10 was the camera. It had a 60 millimeter Vivitar macro lens, a 55 millimeter Vivitar macro lens on it. And police departments would use those to take mugshot pictures. Well, when I install them and put them together with the flash units and everything, I had to test the cameras to make sure that the lighting was right. So I would use myself as a test. That particular police department where that picture came from, the guy was a friend of mine. He sent the roll of film with my picture on it down to the regional crime lab. They processed it. They put it in every police department database in the state of Ohio. I was shooting a video job in Northern Scotland back in 2000. And they had that picture on the door to the pub when I went in.
Oh my.
I mean, that picture has followed me everywhere.
I never heard that story. That's hilarious. Good question. Yeah,
they said they were going to put it in the sexual offender database, but they didn't. They did not do that. They didn't. They drew the line at that point.
He was on America's Most Wanted. That's a good question.
Well, if you saw the picture, I had real long hair.
Yeah, and you had a lot of hair.
Mustache. I had a lot of dark hair and a scruffy mustache, and I had my Pendleton Chief Joseph jacket on, which is all multiple colors. And
I love you, Paul. And I mean this in the nicest way possible, but boy, it was a believable picture.
Well, you know, it was funny because at that time I was doing a lot of work with police departments. So I spent a lot of time in police departments and also at the military installations at Wright-Patterson. And I just never paid any attention to it. But I did get some funny looks from time to time.
So I don't need to start. I don't need to keep looking at the serial numbers of all the cameras that you send me just to check if they've been stolen.
With a black, gotta get a black light. Look for some hidden messages.
Yeah, let's have another question.
Kevin Dillon has written in and said to all the hosts, are there any second tier or store branded SLRs you secretly enjoy using? For example, Ricoh, Chinon, Sears, Focal, Sigma, Petri, Forst, Pony, etc., etc.
King Regula.
Yes.
Did they ever private label King Regulas? I mean, did Sears or JCPenney's or Kmart or anyone rebadge a King Regula?
I don't think so, Paul.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think they would have dared.
Well, I mean, I just literally last week I posted a review of the Sears TLS, which was a rebranded Ricoh TLS. Real nice camera. I mean, it's pretty rudimentary. It's a basic, fully mechanical 35 millimeter SLR, but it's got, you know, match needle metering in it. Normally it's found with the Ricoh 1.4 55 millimeter lens, which is really, really sharp. It's a great shooter. I mean, it's a heavy, big, brutish mechanical camera. And my favorite feature, ironically, is the logo on it. For a very short period of time, Sears Roebuck Company, which was a, you know, major department store in the United States, had this, they called it the atomic logo, where they made, it looks like an atom, but it's very cleverly got the letters SR in it. So it, at first glance, you don't see it. It's one of those things you kind of have to stare at it for a second to see the SR in it, but it's a really, really cool logo. And one of our, I think it was on the Discord, somebody not only had that same camera that I reviewed, but they had a butter dish that they had, someone had bought from Sears back then, and it had the atomic SR logo on it too. So apparently they put that logo on more than just one. But in terms of store branded cameras, I mean, there's a whole bunch of really great cameras that there were store versions of.
I think Tower, I mean, you think it,
yeah,
look at the Tower, great, my Tower 22. I mean, and also Sears made or had Sears branded K-mount lenses that are real sleeper lenses.
Yeah. There was the Konica Auto Dash Reflex, the one that can do full and half frame. There's German department store versions of that camera review. You'll find if you go on eBay and search for REVUE, that brand, there's a whole bunch of other cameras, Japanese, even some Soviet stuff that was rebranded. So, I mean, to answer the original question, what's your favorite store branded camera? It's hard to say because there were so many great A-list cameras by Pentax and other companies that could have been sold under those names. One of the very first reviews I ever did on my site when I just got going was called the Wards AAM or AM551. And all it is just a Konica Auto S2, but for the Montgomery Wards Corporation. So you could find... So, you know, it's weird. Sometimes the store branded versions are actually more expensive because they're rarer for collectors that like to be like the completists. Sometimes it can be harder to find the store versions. But on the other hand, sometimes those slip under the radar because people don't know what they are.
I think one of the best cameras made in the 80s was actually the Ricoh XR2, which later was also sold as a Sigma SA1. I mean, it was a Pentax K-mount camera, electronically controlled shutter, depth of field preview. One of the versions had multiple exposure. I mean, it was just a really full-featured aperture priority, full manual camera that took a power winder. I don't think it had any TTL flash, but it had everything else that you could possibly want. It was like a Nikon FE, but with Pentax K-mount lenses. Very cool camera.
And some of the Vivitar M42 lenses are pretty nice as well.
Yeah.
The camera bodies are definitely one thing that you can get into that are easy to tell what they originally were, but it's the lenses that are the real rabbit hole. There are so many people posting online, does anyone know who made this lens? And even with major brands, there are so many where you don't know what factory they came out of. And as soon as you get into a strange store brand lens, even if you figure out where one lens came with, a different focal length, yeah, or even one made 10 years later of the same focal length could come out of a different factory.
It's amazing the lens manufacturers of the 60s and 70s, the 50s, 70s that are no longer around, but the newer Chinese manufacturers that are around today. it just seems that where we fall off, you know, I worked for a chain of stores called Underground Camera, and we actually went over to Japan and sourced three different lens manufacturers to do our own house brand lenses. So even at a small, I think we had 100 camera stores, and we had to go to three different manufacturers to fulfill, you know, wide angles, telephoto zooms, and wide angle zooms. It's pretty interesting.
Well, the big guys at one point was Makina.
Yeah.
They made the majority of the aftermarket type lenses. Then there were others like Asanuma. The number one brand, the best was Tomioka.
Tomioka.
Komine.
Yeah, Komine. Komine made a lot of...
Rumor has it that a lot of the earlier Sears lenses, like the 55 1.4s, were Tomioka lenses as well.
Yeah, and Ricoh's, that Ricoh that Mike just... That's a Tomioka lens.
Yes, yeah. I own it.
The one you want to find, and I've only ever seen one, and it came to me in a bucket, was the Tomioka 55 millimeter 1.2.
I'll bring it again.
I forgot about that. You have the second one.
Yes.
The one I had was so damaged that Yuxin wouldn't even look at it.
Really?
Wow. He looked at it and he sent it back. But I sold it to some guy in Chicago in the original bucket for an astronomical amount of money, in the hopes that he'd be able to put it back together.
It's got the rear element is notched, right?
It is.
Down here in Australia, Hamanex, well, sold pretty much anything. You could never, you could probably trace back what they were, but they just jump from brand to brand to brand to brand, which you could pick up some really good bargains here in Australia, but you can also pick up a lot of junk because you never know, especially with the lenses, as you said, you don't know who made them. Mamiya used to pimp themselves out pretty much to everybody and make cameras and lenses and so on. That was before they made the best camera in the world, the Mamiya 7.
Mamiya 7,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. But
Panamex is like the Australian version of Calamar.
Exactly.
Yeah, they imported anything. Some stuff would have their name on it, some stuff wouldn't. They'd have Soviet stuff, they'd have Japanese stuff, German stuff rebranded.
And it was all mixed up together too.
Right.
You could potentially buy a Soviet SLR with a Japanese lens, which they paired up, and they put Hanamex name on it.
So I have a question that came through my site. It was from someone named Steven. I don't think it was you though, Steven. So I'm going to, before I answer this one, it was, let me bring it up. What does your wife think of all your cameras? So I know all of us, Paul, Theo, and Anthony, and myself, we're all married. So what's the female, what are their thoughts on your hobby?
In my case, technically my wife buys all my cameras because we share the eBay account. And so people don't actually realize it's actually me buying them most of the times. It's actually her name. It's and she's got, you know, a great reputation as being a collector on eBay of cameras.
Well, she eggs you on, doesn't she? Tell you to go look at Paul's store and pick something.
She does. She's an enabler, and sometimes, you know, probably too much, too generous. But I won't complain. She's the best.
What about you, Anthony? What does your wife think about your hobby?
It keeps me off the streets.
Yeah. Mine, I didn't necessarily think I'd go in the direction that I did when I first started, I guess, collecting. It was just sort of a side thing, you know, and she just sort of kind of ignored it. And then when it started getting a little bit bigger and I needed more space, it was kind of like, you know, you're leaving cameras and stuff on the kitchen table. And that was probably quite annoying. And then as the site grew, and packages started showing up left and right from people, you know, she's just kind of like, Mike, this is getting a lot of control. But then I think, you know, she kind of hit a point where she started meeting, you know, she's met Paul, she's met Bob Rodoloni, she's met Vlad Kern, a couple other people too. And she kind of sees the community and she's pretty supportive. When I built the shelves that I have all my cameras sitting on, she's like, that's actually really cool. So, you know, it's allowed me to do some cool stuff that I wouldn't otherwise get to do, you know, fly out to Los Angeles, meet Rudy, partake in disseminating Kurt's collection. And, you know, she was buying my airline tickets. She was finding the Airbnb for me to stay in when I was in LA. So she's been really supportive. Paul?
I am Chris's burden to bear. I mean, she, she goes to the basement now and just shakes her head.
Well, and you're different though, because like Theo and I, and maybe even Anthony, we started becoming collectors at some point, but you've, between working in a store and owning your own store, this has been your whole life, for at least for as long as you've known her, right?
Yeah. So we met in a camera store.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so we both worked in the same store, but you know, what happened is it did get out of control. I mean, prior to Kurt in his collection, my eBay store had at most 100 pieces. And now this morning I'm 805.
Wow.
So, I mean, it just, and it's all in this house. I mean, yeah, every single thing that I have for sale is in this house. So try to find it once I sell something can be a real issue. I'm only somewhat organized. So
I had been working with cameras, you know, through various jobs or through school, you know, since I was in my early 20s. So I already had all my cameras by the time I'd met Janet. And, you know, I lost a significant number of cameras in a home invasion robbery about 9 years ago, and, you know, put my cameras, I couldn't take another shot. I just couldn't pick up a camera for years. And then when we were in Berlin, at a cacao conference, actually, we were in the old East German sector. We came across this really cool shop called Klick und Sur. And I saw a couple of Voigtlanders and some Minox cameras. And Janet's like, don't you think it's time you get a camera again? Don't you think it's time to, you know, these are really cool. Maybe you want to get a camera. And so we went back to the shop the next day, and I walked in and I picked up a Voigtlander Vito. And she's like, have you always wanted one of those Minoxes? Why don't you get one of those Minoxes as well? And the guy behind the camera just stops dead. And he goes, this is your wife? And I said, yeah. He goes, he's perfect.
Nice.
Yeah. So she has been an enabler, and she knows how much that, you know, how much I enjoy doing this. And so at this point, I think she tolerates it. But also she appreciates the photography and the fact that it gets me out of the house and gets me out and into the woods and keeps me active. So she at this point it's a mixed blessing, because of course when I came back from Germany, that's when I realized that everybody was selling cameras dirt cheap on eBay. And it's like, oh, you know, I used to drop this much money on a DSLR, and just, I remember spending that much on a lens, and I can buy you know, a camera a week and spend less money than that. But that's kind of where I stand. But I definitely had I had a lot of cameras by the time I met Janet.
Steven, are you married?
I have a partner who is being very supportive and has not only supported me in buying things, but also has picked some things up while she's traveling for me, and has sold things as well. If I'm at work or if she's traveling somewhere where somebody wants to buy something, she'll take it along with her and sell it. And also my mom as well. I've left some things at her house in another town, had buyers go there and pick it up. So it's gotten to the point where my mom and my partner are in a group chat that they've named Steven's Cameras and Accessories Sales Team.
Nice.
That's terrific.
Can I get in there too?
Yeah.
They can help sell some stuff for me.
You know, we should have a Canadian branch. That would be a Canadian branch of the Camerosity store.
It's definitely different up here in that Kijiji is the popular thing other than Craigslist, but Facebook Marketplace has definitely taken it over, and it's very difficult now to get cameras shipped from other countries, and fees are increasing. Even buying things within Canada from eBay, we're now paying sales tax on them that we weren't earlier. So a lot of things have changed in the last couple of years.
What's frustrating for me is, like, I expect to pay high shipping to get something shipped from Australia or Germany or whatever, but to even sell to Canada is so expensive. The United States and Canada have the world's longest unpatrolled border. I mean, there's you could drive into Canada, and apart from things being in kilometers and Celsius and your love for poutine, it's basically like the United States. I mean, the two countries have so much in common, but for Canadians to buy stuff from US sellers is just so expensive.
But that's common across the world in terms of buying from the US now, because I find, like, I could buy things from the UK or from, you know, from Japan. Yeah. Granted, Japan's a lot closer, but it's almost half what it'll cost to buy something from the US these days in terms of shipping. And I don't know what's happened in the US. Why has shipping become so expensive? Is it, have the unions really taken hold or something?
This box is going to the UK. I mean, it's 8 inches by 6 inches. It's a plain box, 3 pounds. It was $45 was the cheapest just to send it. And it's worth it for what's inside there. But I mean, if you just wanted to pick up something cheap and you're going to pay $45 minimum, you know, and to get, if that box was 4 pounds instead of 3 pounds, it probably would have been 60, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. And then after you pay for the shipping, usually you get hit with VAT and other, you know, tariffs and taxes and stuff. So, but believe me, I'm not bragging, but it is, if you're in the US getting stuff, cause we don't have to deal with that. I've had plenty of things come to me and there's no additional hidden charges. Just sometimes it doesn't show up.
I will actually buy a lot of things now from Japan, from Yahoo Auctions Japan through Baiyi. And I'm paying for shipping within Japan, then consolidating the packages and having them shipped to Canada. And I'm paying a fraction of what it would cost for me to get something from the US. And that's just crazy.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. David, where are you from?
I'm in Toronto.
You're in Toronto? Okay. I'm in Montreal.
Yeah, I basically allow things to sort of what we call care packages from Paul to accumulate a few things that are on the way and then, yeah, and then package it all together because I just won't buy from the US otherwise anymore.
Yeah.
It's just too expensive and cheap. In terms of before we go into the next question, in terms of partners and so on supporting, one development here has been Noel has actually been joining me at the camera fairs. The camera markets lately too. So that's actually not helped me. You'd think that would actually restrain me, but that's actually not helped me where it's actually been getting worse. So that's...
Well, Paul and I are going to get to meet Ray's wife. So I'll ask her directly.
She's done two shows. I've been doing shows for almost 35 years. And out of 35 years, she's done two. And this last one we did in Boston at, you know, FISNY used to be twice a year. It was the biggest in the U.S. It was 2 days, spring and fall. I brought her in and I had three tables. I brought just the things I couldn't care. I just want to get rid of. Everything was $5. And she just had and I said, this is your responsibility. Here's an 8-foot table. It's $5. There's, you know, every item is $5, period, but have fun. And she had a blast. But everything I purchased, she's like, Raymond, do you really need that? No, I want it.
Yeah.
Sell more. So we'll see how she does. I'm not going to bring the schmeck, if you would, out to Cincinnati. It's not worth the the effort. I may try some auction. I have some photography and camera early auction booklets and some early catalogs, magazines, if you would, from the 50s. See what happens.
Jumping on to the next question. We've got a few through Instagram. One's from Ron Jameson. When will Tantamarkin be dropping by again? We need at least a yearly visit by Dan.
Dan Tamarkin, yes.
Well, I said Dan. I actually forwarded that question to Dan. And he replied and said, he laughed. I said, your fans are clamoring for your appearance. And he laughed and said he would be glad to come back. So we'll put Dan on the list for an upcoming episode.
Not the next one, but two from this one. So 68 is going to be April Fool's Day. So maybe we could have some fun on April 1st. And maybe we'll get them to come for that one. Make it a fun one.
We could talk about rumors. How about
rumors?
What do we know about this new half-frame Ricoh?
Oh, the Ricoh?
Yeah.
Crickets.
It's Pentax, isn't it?
Crickets is about right. I mean, yeah. It's basically is an upgraded Kodak.
They said it has an SBO lens, so it's going to have just like a point and shoot lens and a half frame camera. I mean, I'm all for new products, but it just doesn't interest me at all.
And this is Pentax. As Pentax was talking about a point and shoot 35 and releasing an SLR 35.
Yeah.
No, I think on half frame burst.
Really?
This is the step below that. I got in trouble on Reddit last night. There's an analog discussion group, and this guy posts a picture of a Concord focus-free plastic camera and says, this is $5. Is it worth it? And I said, You're going to spend $7 on a lousy roll of film. You're going to spend another $10 to $12 getting it processed, and you're going to have shitty pictures. What's the point? And so everybody is going, no, he should be. I says, you're process oriented. That's fine. If you're goal oriented, you're not going to be happy with what you get.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get banned?
Yeah, I didn't get banned, but I got chastised.
I'm excited about this Pentax camera. It actually sounds, it's half frame. It's going to have modern optics in it. It's going to have automated aperture and shutter priority and otherwise manual controls. It sounds like it's like a half frame XA with a little bit of electronics in it. I think it's going to be a cool thing.
It's a good stepping stone.
Yeah, I think if that's the intent and that's their first step, and it's going to be like that Kodak HK, whatever it's called, that's actually the one that's better than you'd think, but it's just a basic plastic camera. I would hope it's going to be something better than that.
Oh, it's definitely not going to be like that. I mean, okay. they've already talked about specifics, and it's going to have, modern aperture control.
Isn't it
going to
have a wind lever?
It's going to have manual winding.
Okay.
And it's going to be zone focus. That's cool. But with modern electronics and a modern lens.
Nice.
I'm excited. AJ, did you have a question?
Yeah. Of you guys shooting film, do you do your own, you have your own dark rooms, or you just scan your images?
I develop myself. I do black and white and C41. Yeah. I've never bothered to learn how to do slide film, okay. But I don't have a dark room because I don't do any printing or enlarging at all. I just do in the basement here, we have a third bathroom with no windows. So when it's time to put the film in the tank, I just go in there, turn the lights off, stick a towel in the bottom of the door, and I load in the dark there. And then in my laundry room or furnace room, I have a utility sink and I do all my developing there. So I develop, and then I have a scanner here that I scan for myself. You kind of have to, unless you're just doing like a roll a month, every other month, maybe the price for mail order processing, it just would kill me.
Yeah.
So being able to do it myself, and then you could further economize by using bulk film.
Yeah.
So that's a good way of doing it too. But yeah, I do it myself.
Yeah. I've started giving demonstrations on film development.
It's fun. I mean, it's easy. I mean, it's amazing.
And it's cheaper than everybody thinks.
Yeah. I laugh at how specific some people can be.
Yeah.
Like they'll measure it down to the second, how long each step has to be. And I'm not saying there aren't any rules, but they're far more forgiving than people give it credit for.
Well, there's so much more latitude with film.
Yeah.
I'd always had a dark room, and it had always, I've got my enlarger and all my trays and everything, but my current house that I've been in since 2003 is sort of an open plan, mid-century modern Florida house. And there's not a room that isn't just walls of windows. And so I actually had made like these cutouts out of foam core with felt around the edges with handles that I could like push into these windows. And I tried to set it up in our bathroom and then realized that there was not enough ventilation. And I just about fried my lungs the first time I had an extended developing session. And that's when I decided that I didn't really need a dark room. So I've got like a really nice, I've got the Canon Pro 3000 printer. And I've got, multiple scanners. I've got dedicated slide scanners, flatbed scanners. And I do, unlike Mike, I do everything. I do slide. I do ECN2. I do C41. And, I am really obsessed with weird expired films. And so I've got all sorts of like oddball developers, like, the stuff to mix my own POTA developer for using TechPan and doing my own rim jet removal, with the old Eastman formula for using Cine films. So, I do all the developing and then all the scanning and then print to stupidly expensive inkjet, professional grade printers.
Do you know what's really impressive about you, Anthony, though, is you actually shoot film, you have it processed, you have it scanned, and you're sharing it with us usually faster than I could actually shoot with digital and get it loaded.
He'll get it the same day sometimes. So, I just got this camera in the mail, and it'll be 10 a.m. And then by like 7 p.m. that night, he's already posting scans from the film he shot in it. So
yeah, we're gonna have a sign made for Anthony. It says Anthony's 59-minute photo.
Well, you know, it's a discipline. You know, it's like, because I used to do this professionally, and I would have to have my film ready to go. On the same day, you know, because you wanted to see what you did before you had to shoot again the next day. Right. Yeah. And so it's just, it's an old habit that I can't break.
I actually don't process my film. I don't have the time to spare, to be honest, with my kind of job that I do. So it is something where there's a lab about 5 minutes away from where I live. So, and it's a lab I've been using for about 25 years. So I know them well. I know the guys well.
That's cool.
And I'll literally just drop off the film, and I'll probably head off this afternoon actually quickly and just drop some off, and a few days later they'll have it ready and I'll pick it up. I do scan it myself though, because I feel that if you're not at least doing that part yourself, you're giving the whole artistic merit to someone else, right, to do for you and interpret it for you. So I will spend the time scanning it myself, but I can do that at home while I'm doing something else, or I'll complain to the family where they're not giving me enough time to do it. So it'll be one or the other. But generally, I'll just get the processing done and then the rest is up to me.
Okay.
Good question. All right.
Should we jump to another online one?
Yeah, go for it.
Gus Kilpatrick sent one through Instagram. What other hobbies or collections have you strayed into through cameras? I'm worried I'm going too deep into field audio recordings and microphones.
Ooh.
I'll say watches. That's probably the one I've done that strayed into on and off. I kind of stray on and off. With one of my favorite pieces of my collection is a 1960s Amiga Constellation, which has got all the original features on it. And it's just gorgeous, and it's gold-plated, white-faced. I wish I'd actually thought of that in advance to actually bring it and show it here, but I can post a picture of it when we put up the actual recordings.
I found a YouTube channel of a guy, I can't remember his name, but he restores Rolexes, and like he actually tears them down, like pulls the springs out, like complete teardowns, and it's mesmerizing.
Yeah, a friend of mine does that with Amigas, and he loves it. He'll get anybody's broken Amigas, and he'll pick them up at bargain prices, and then he'll pull them right down, replace all the jewels, and do all that kind of stuff. And it's just magic.
I find myself being interested in any type of old technology of any kind. I mean, I'm attracted to old typewriters. I'm attracted to old computers. You know, I think it would be awesome to get like an old, you know, Commodore Amiga or an Altair 8080 or some kind of old computer up and running. I think Johnny Martyr told me that he has a interest in vintage refrigerators, you know, so that's got to be a tough hobby to justify to the wife, collecting refrigerators. But I've been successful at limiting myself to just cameras. I have like one or two old telephones, the rotary phones. I have a Pioneer SX750 receiver from the 70s that I had fully restored, recapped, the power supply rebuilt, all the little bulbs replaced with LEDs, and I have a turntable, so I like to listen to music. But in terms of collecting, I've kept it to cameras.
You know, the filmmaker Werner Herzog said that all frustrated filmmakers are good cooks, and so I'm obsessed with old cookbooks. I have a library of just cookbooks.
That's cool.
And it's fun because I cook out of all of them. And so, you know, I might spend, you know, $30 on a cookbook, but then, you know, cook what would have been hundreds of dollars worth of meals out of it if I'd gone out. So cookbooks and then vinyl. I mean, I've got so much vinyl. I used to work as, you know, record store clerk and college radio DJ, and would, you know, walk off with armloads of vinyl. And you know, as I would used to move around all the time when I was in grad school, you know, it was like I had records, books, and cameras. And that was my life. Yeah. Records, books, and cameras.
I love vinyl as well.
With watches, fountain pens, and bamboo fly rods.
Fountain pens. That's cool.
Fountain pens are like the poor man's watch, if you would. Yeah. I I also love seeing this, a couple of watch restorers from Japan and from the UK that are just phenomenal. I get so lost in the process of them doing, if you would, a CLA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Having to remake parts. Fountain pens are honestly not as difficult as a watch. So I own a lot of fountain pens. A lot of
I was bit by that for about 10 years and I still have some really cool fountain pens.
Well, I've been into fountain pens for like 50 years.
Yeah. So,
I started at a very young age, and I tell you, it's interesting to go to these different shows. Like I've been in the photographic industry all my life, and usually behind in not, you know, working these events, not attending. And it's so weird to be on, you know, the opposite side of the table.
So Paul, with you, it's banjos, mandolins, and diddly bows, right?
Just guitars. You know, I went through watches. I had 6 or 7 Breitlings that I liked a lot. And then when I retired, I haven't worn a watch in 14 years. And all of them that I have now are electronic watches, and the batteries are dead on all of them. I have no mechanical watches. I had 3 winders at one point that wound 4 watches each. I think I'm down to 8. No, I'm down to 10 acoustic guitars at this point. But what I really collect, and I haven't bought any in years, but I started collecting photographs. And the first photograph I bought was a Cartier-Bresson. I bought it from a gallery in Santa Fe. And then I bought a Willie Ronnie from the same gallery. And then that led to buying the Westons. I have Edward, Brett, and Cole. I have one of each of them. I have Paul Caponegro's. I have 2 of his pictures. So I've got a pretty good collection of photographs that I have them on the wall. I mean, they're not anything that I hide away. But, you know, they can, it can turn into a lot of money really quick because.
Well, what hobby doesn't?
Well, the Cartier-Bresson's at 11 by 14. And it was a gallery print. I mean, it wasn't a secondary market print. It was one, he was still alive. So they came from his agent directly to the gallery where I bought it. And I think it was something like $4,000. And he died. And when he died, the price went from $4,000 to $10,000 overnight because no more were going to be available on the new market. It's only secondary market. But that's all I don't really collect anything anymore. My wife collects pictures of dead presidents.
Are they grain?
On paper, yeah.
Ray, you mentioned Dan Cooney, and I know he likes collecting old photographs too, maybe not necessarily famous ones, but just interesting pictures, and he shares them a lot on Facebook, and he's fine.
The cool thing about Dan, it's not pictures. He's actually primarily buying negatives or glass plates.
Okay, and then he scans them?
And the majority of them that he gets them, he's buying them from is over in Europe, believe it or not.
He's found some really cool ones.
He's got some great images. I hooked up with it was either Ohio or Pennsylvania in the Amish areas. I found this antique mall. I had a day to kill when I was in the middle of nowhere. And they probably had 350 varying glass plates. And most of them were consumer, amateur, no big deal. You know, I quickly reviewed them, but I had to call him for a business meeting, for a business question. And I told him, I said, you know, I just missed this camera. There was a postcard camera there that they wanted a lot of money for. That was kind of unusual, being that it was in the Amish area, but the glass plates. And he ended up, I gave him the name of the store. He ended up calling and negotiating sight unseen for the entire lot. Think about having 350 glass plates.
Shipped? Yeah. And
this isn't a professional auction house. This is, you know, just a we'll call it the Podunk antique shop.
Well, we're getting close to the end here, I think. Maybe we have time for one or two more questions if we go quick.
We have one more on Instagram.
One more. Okay.
And it's from Christopher Wells, and it's a two-part question. I'm not sure if this has been mentioned before, but what camera was the first one which each of you acquired or were given? Additionally, if each of you were to start over completely and could pick one film camera from history for shooting/to collect, what would it be? Any brand and any format? And in brackets, I know what Theo would say for the second part.
My first was a Kodak number one junior folding autographic something. 116 camera. I didn't know what the hell it was. It just looked neat. Had no idea. I'd never even seen a roll film camera before. Had no idea that 116 you couldn't even get anymore. I found another blogger named Mike Keneally, who still posts from time to time. He had a short article on how to adapt 120 into a 116 camera. So that was my first antique film camera. But then the second one was a Nikon EL2. And I'll answer the second part of that question is I would stick with the Nikon EL2. I mean, it's not necessarily the best Nikon, but it was a great way to get into the hobby.
My first was a Beacon.
The White House?
I think I was six. And my dad was a photographer. So, you know, I got the Beacon. And my first serious camera was a Yashica J, which I loved.
I know Bob Ronaloni's first camera was a Taron, like a Taron rangefinder. I think he said he bought it in eighth grade.
Like Paul, my father was an amateur photographer fanatic and always buying the latest, greatest. And I would inherit cameras from him. So when I was in junior, maybe seventh grade, he gave me an Olympus RC. And I know that I used it to shoot a bunch of concerts. I've actually posted some photos from like Blondie in 1978. And Devo in 1979 that I shot with that Olympus RC. Unfortunately, being rowdy kid in Florida, I got tossed into a pool at a party while carrying my camera. And that was the end of the Olympus RC. Then I inherited my dad's Kodak Retina Reflex 3 because he had long since moved in from that. I still have it. I was lucky enough to be able to send it off to Chris Sherwood to have it refurbed before Chris got
Chris
out of
Sherlock
the business.
Took it before he retired. Yeah, that's awesome.
And I love that camera. I still shoot it. That Xenon 50mm lens is still one of the great SLR lenses.
Oh, absolutely. It's razor sharp.
Yeah. Those are my first two cameras. And then the first camera I ever purchased was my freshman year in college. Needed to pick up an SLR that was a more modern camera than that camera. Although my dad had given me his SX70, you talked about film prices, you know, even in 1980, 81, I could not afford to shoot that SX70 because that film was crushingly expensive at the time. Mm-hmm. And, so I went on to B&H and ordered a brand new Nikon FM2 and I still have that camera to this day. The first camera I ever purchased with the FM2, and that's still sort of my take it anywhere in the tropics. That camera's been around the world so many times. It's been on boats, it's been in the desert, it's been up on mountains, and it's still my go anywhere, you know, rock solid camera is the FM2.
For me, my parents, neither of them were into anything creative. They were immigrants to Australia. They just basically believe that you should just work as much as you can to sort of build a life and so on. So they didn't really have an outlet in that respect. But my dad used to shoot for the family photos, though, a Polaroid 1000, the SX70 box camera, effectively. I've still got that. And that's one of the, you know, one of the first cameras I inherited was given. But I did buy as quite a young lad when I did wanted to start take pictures of being out and about with my friends and so on. A Canon Sure Shot type camera, so that was a nice little compact type thing. So I came in a bit late into the photography in that sense. Basically, I think Christopher's got it right in terms of if I'd have to pick one camera to hold on to and then shoot all the time, it would be the Mamiya 7 because I just enjoy using it so much and I enjoy seeing the results out of it. Quite straightforward.
Steven, AJ, or Ray, real quick, you want to throw in yours?
My first camera was just a cheap 110 camera, but my first serious camera was an Olympus XA that my father owned, and he allowed me to use that at sort of special times. And he owned that because he was an aircraft maintenance engineer, and it was a camera that he didn't need a case for, and it was very small. So he would just put that in his coveralls and climb into an airplane, climb into the engine, and take pictures for inspection purposes. And when he was no longer using that as a professional camera, it was still sort of a special piece. And using that and having a rangefinder and aperture priority was really what started me off on cameras a lot, I think.
That's cool.
Yeah, and for me, it was either a Kodak, you know, 126 or a Kodak disc camera. But my first serious was in middle school, sixth or seventh grade, where it was a Nikon F. And my dream camera, if you would, that I couldn't live without. There's two options there. One is a Leica M2 and the other is a Mamiya 6.
AJ?
My first camera was my dad's Minolta XD11 that I got right here.
That's an awesome camera.
Yeah, and it's a brick.
Yeah.
And honestly, my favorite cameras, wow. I love my Leica 3F as a 35 millimeter, but I love large format for me. 4x5 has always been, yeah.
Well, I answered the question of what my first camera was when I got into collecting, but if my first ever camera I remember when I was a kid was a, like you, Steve, and I had a 110. It was a blue, black and yellow Fisher Price, but it was like a rebadged Kodak something. I remember it had a neck strap with a quick, like anti-choke quick release and real thick rubber edges so that, you know, for children that would drop it. I remember my parents taking me to the Chicago Auto Show and I'd go through a roll of film just snapping pictures of cars. But that would have been my first actual camera when I was a child.
Does Paul have a camera for you?
I have a Fisher Price. They came from Kurt, actually.
I saw, yeah.
He sent me that.
I remember exactly when I remember where in his house that was. It was in the hallway. He didn't even put it in the room. I have a quick lightning round for you guys. So this is my question. Name a camera that everybody or a lot of people really like, but you don't. I'll start. I just can't get into like the Nikon F5, F6s. I think they're technologically impressive cameras, but they're just too big for me. I don't enjoy holding them. I don't enjoy using them. They're just not for me.
My bet noir is the Hasselblad 500 series.
Yeah.
Cannot gel with that camera. Just cannot gel with that Hasselblad. Even the SWC, which is a camera that I would be predisposed to love. I didn't like, I mean, I like the results that I got with it, but I hated shooting it.
Yeah. Theo?
Mine would have to be the Kodak Retinette. I just never really liked that camera. I don't know why. I love the Retina, but I just don't like the Retinette at all.
I never met a Minolta that I liked.
Really?
Never. I mean, you know, I can, and I had to think about that because I don't have a lot of experience with Canon, but I like the EF. I don't have a lot of experience with the Pentax, but I like the LX. You know, but a Minolta, I don't think I've ever picked one up that I really had any desire to shoot a picture with.
Oh, wow.
That's shots fired there.
I got all the SRTs over here.
I just, you know, it's just for some reason, there's nothing there that interests me.
Paul, not even the XK?
The XK, you know, actually, the XK sort of left me cold. The XD11 was a nice camera. Mm-hmm. But basically because it was a Leica.
I know.
and I'll go in between those two. I like the XE7. To me, that's the perfect
Minolta. Yeah, XE7, which was also a Leica.
It's basically like the Nicker Matte to the Nikon F. So you have the XK, which was their pro camera, and then the XE7 was still a large body, fixed prism, robust camera, but it still had metering.
Yeah, it was an R3. But, you know, they've XE7s have really held up well.
Yeah, they have.
They don't have the problem the X700 has.
No, the caps.
Yes. I mean, they're actually a very well-made camera.
Yeah. Steven?
The only cameras that I've never been able to get along with are, I think it's the original FE and FM, where the wind lever, when it's pushed against the body, locks the shutter release. Was it the original ones or the twos that did that?
A lot of Nikons do that.
Yeah. It was just a case of, I shoot a lot of vertical photos and I shoot it with the right side of the camera pointing up and that lever hits me in the forehead and I lock the camera and can't take a picture with it, can't get my eye to the viewfinder. And I mean, I've shot with a lot of weird cameras. I've shot with broken cameras and tried to figure out how to get them to work. But that was the only thing that I came across where it was just, no, I cannot deal with this at all.
Well, don't ever pick up a Shinon Bellamy or whatever. It's got barn doors. When you fold the wind lever back in, it actually retracts the lens. So the wind lever actually opens and closes the lens.
And I'll jump in here and say, listeners, please disregard everything Stephen just said because that's the latest review on photothinking.com. And go there to see a good review.
AJ, did you give us an answer?
I gotta agree with you there, Mike. Mind you, I'd go the F4 and up for me. The Nikons, my God.
I have an F5. It's nice. It's a good camera, but
they're huge.
They're so huge. Yeah, I just shot with an EOS 1NRS literally 2 days ago, and it was fine to use. The one thing I like about it is it has the pellicle mirror, so when you fire, it's like a Pelix. So when you fire the shutter, there's no blackout. So that was cool. But other than that, I felt like I was holding a bowling ball to my face every time I needed to look at the viewfinder.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love the F5, but it's you got to use it for the right reasons. It's not.
Yeah.
It's
a great camera.
Yeah, it's a fantastic camera. Yeah, I'll take it out for sports photography or something like that, or some going somewhere rugged. But I wouldn't necessarily have it for something to carry around the street with and take, you know, street photography with.
Well, I think that's a good spot to end there. We had some great questions. Wanted to thank everybody who submitted something to ask us. I think we'll do something like this again, but please don't wait for another Ask Us Anything episode. We will take questions for any episode. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a reader mailbag. We have the Ask the Hosts forum on the Discord server, but obviously Instagram, Facebook page, my website, whatever, you know, join the show, ask us a question. That's the concept. I think the most fun part of the show is just, you know, talking to you guys and hearing what you want us to talk about or ask us or something like that. So the next episode, today's the 4th. We're going to record on the 18th, right? Is that right? Yeah. March 18th at the regular time. I did get a hold of Rick Olison. We talked about getting him on a couple episodes back, and he's going to try and make it for that one. So hopefully his calendar will stay open, but Rick Olison should join us then. There's a high probability we'll get into camera repair then if he's on the show, but Rick has a tremendous level of knowledge too. Remember Paul, Ray and I are going to be at the Cincinnati camera show at the Westchester Hilton, right? Hilton Garden Inn.
Right.
Hilton Garden, yeah. And the following day is the Cleveland show.
Yeah, I won't go to that one, but I'll be at the one in Cincinnati on the 23rd, the 24th, the very next day in Cleveland. There'll be a show there too. So maybe if you guys are thinking of coming, at least just say hi, buy a camera from us. We'll give you a discount. We'll just have to be, won't let too many people know. You got to use a secret password. That you know us. We had a couple people drop off. Miles, Patrick, and Mark dropped off. They had other commitments. But as always, the topics and discussions on the Camerosity podcast are influenced by you. We love hearing from our returning guests, but we like hearing stuff from new people too. That's it. So you guys have a good rest of your week.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Wonderful week, everybody.
All right. Yeah. Good night.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. So say Geronimo, say Geronimo, say Geronimo.
She always tells me I don't listen. She's like, you don't listen. You never listen. I've heard that every time. And I don't think I listen to everything. But I also don't think she says everything she thinks she says. There's just no way. 17 years of marriage, you're bad in 1,000. I'm over. I've never heard anything. She might say it all in her mind, but I mean, not everything makes it out of that maze up there. She started selling stuff online on Facebook Marketplace, and I found this out from a guy at my front door. I don't even really know what it is. I think it's just putting your home address on the open internet. She doesn't sell used cars. There's not like a big money coming in. She sells stuff that should be thrown away. She sold an old kids folding chair for $5. Best case scenario, we receive $5. Worst case, our whole family is murdered.